good Monday morning to you. It's August 7th, and this is Mountain Money on KPCW Radio. I'm Renee Bodley. My co-host, Doug Wells, is on vacation today.
He's again?
Again, Bob. Bob Hendricks, our esteemed producer, is co-hosting with us today. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Some nice guests today.
Wonderful guests today. In studio with us is Mark Pittman. He started a company called Blinksy. He's the CEO of Blinksy. This man may be the reason why we have not suffered another Carmageddon like we did in December of 2014. We'll hear how he uses real-time traffic data to help municipalities with their traffic flow issues. That's going to be really interesting. And you said he has some good information about this last weekend.
Just over the Arts Fest weekend, he said he was watching from the comfort of his office.
Seeing the real-time traffic flow.
That's right, yes.
Oh, cool. And then after that, we're hoping to have the folks from Freshies in. They've been hard to pin down, but
they've been so busy.
Yeah. Yep. And anyone who goes by Freshies these days, this is the company that sells lobster rolls, and they just won Best Lobster Roll Contest in New England. Guys, a company in Utah, a restaurant in Utah, wins Best Lobster Roll. How does that happen?
That's right, yep.
We'll hear about that. And then
Dr. Michael Kagan will be in talking about concierge medicine. Concierge medicine in Park City, what that's all about. We'll talk about that.
Yep, pros and cons to that practice. Okay. I can't wait to hear what he has to say. But first, it's cool out there.
It is. It reminded me a little bit of fall as I walked to the post office this morning. 40% chance of scattered thunderstorms today with a high of just 75. It's perfect for me anyway. 50% chance of showers tonight. As a matter of fact, there's a chance of showers today, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And highs just in the 70s. So nice, cool temperatures. And a chance of some precipitation that we could all use. We'll keep you posted as we go through the week if if it becomes a greater chance of showers, because it's just 20 or 30% chance. So we'll be back with our guests following this.
Gordo here, and I'm Larry with All Resort Group, a proud sponsor of KPCW.
We provide transportation to the airport, Park City, and Deer Valley, utilizing private black cars, SUVs, and shared ride van service.
Reservations at allresort.com or 649-3999.
We move people.
This is Allison Kulo with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Did you know that by shopping locally, you strengthen the local economy and support our local infrastructure, trails, parks, and transit system? When you shop or dine in Summit County, those dollars stay in Summit County. The Park City Chamber Bureau is pleased to support KPCW's locally grown radio show, Mountain Money. Remember, keep it local, keep it PC. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley, here with my co-host Bob Hendricks, filling in for Doug Wells this morning. We're real excited about our first guest this morning. Everyone has an opinion about traffic and how to solve traffic problems, especially in Park City. Well, I think we have the one person here with us in studio who maybe put his money where his mouth is, Mark Pittman, founder and CEO of Blinksy. Hi, Mark. Well, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us how you got started with Blinksy. First, explain what it is.
Yeah. So Blinksy was really a reaction to a problem that I had. So in April of 2014, I was a student at the University of Utah. I was leaving campus one night, and I got stuck at a traffic light. And I asked the question, why? Why didn't the traffic light know I was there? Why didn't it turn green? Why did I get stuck and have to find a new way home?
So when you say stuck at a traffic light, the traffic was, it was red, but then it didn't sense that you were there.
Yeah, there were no other cars. It was, you know, late on a Sunday evening.
Frustrating.
Yeah, just the kind of experience we've all probably had, but more usually in a more rural setting. But I had it in downtown Salt Lake. And so I actually reached out to Salt Lake City and to UDOT, and I asked the question, why? And the response I got was, well, we actually have one of the most advanced traffic systems in the nation. UDOT, in particular, leads the country as one of the most innovative departments of transportation. Very, very forward-thinking, very progressive, implemented lots of technology. You really shouldn't be as frustrated as you seem to be. And I said, well, it's not good enough. I want to help you guys figure out how to make it better. And so that's really that was the reaction for Blinksy. So we tried to basically take technology as an application to improve improve transportation efficiency. That's the idea for the company. That's the vision behind what we do, essentially fighting congestion and helping make smarter data-driven decisions in communities.
And you get that data from everyone's cell phone, Fitbit, iPad. They all have something in them that tells you where they are.
Yeah, so we deploy a physical hardware sensor. So you'll see them all around Park City. There's over 100 of them deployed in the area here.
What do they look like?
They're little gray boxes. They'll probably blend right in with traffic infrastructure, and you'll never notice them. Mm. But there's bunches of them up here. They're up and down Park City Main Street. That's the easiest way to go sensor sightseeing. But they're little gray boxes, and what they essentially do is pick up anonymous unique identifiers from devices. So think of it like the business card that your electronic device puts out. Your Wi-Fi and your Bluetooth signals are constantly emitting a unique identifier that they use to connect to a known network, typically things like a Wi-Fi. So basically, you're exchanging business cards with a Wi-Fi with your Wi-Fi all the time, and it's looking to know make connection with a device it knows. But in the process, it's also connecting with other networks that it doesn't know and saying, hey, I don't know you. Goodbye. So we basically passively listen for those devices and put them all together.
Does my device have to be on? If my cell phone is off in my car, it's still?
Nope. We can only pick up a device if it's on and the signal has to be transmitting. So it actually has to have active Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. But your car likely has a Bluetooth signal itself. Almost all new cars have routers built into them that emit their own Wi-Fi signals. Your Fitbit, your iPad, you name it. Our capture rates are between 70 and 110%. Of the population. So at the University of Utah campus, you can imagine students use way more devices than anyone else.
This sounds really CSI-like.
Yeah.
So you know if Renee Bodley has her cell phone on, wherever Renee Bodley goes that day, Blinksy can see where I am?
I don't know who you are. So this is one of the really unique applications of our technology. It's completely anonymous. And last year, we actually worked closely with Utah on passing preemptive legislation at the state level that banned the data from being used essentially to prosecute or investigate you. So we passed a statute here at the legislature with overwhelming support, House Bill 369, that was primarily sponsored by UDOT and supported by Blinksy, that essentially made it possible for this data to be collected. It's anonymized, it's aggregated, it's encrypted. It's more like a San Bernardino type situation. If you
right.
want to re-identify who you are in my system, it's incredibly complex and difficult. And we're one of the only providers that actually allows you to opt out of our system. So we're very, very privacy conscious, very, very forward. And one of the unique applications of our business is we actually own the data. The government does not.
So Blinksy, San Bernardino, just to remind our listeners, that is where there was a shooting and prosecutors wanted access to the alleged shooter's cell phone information. And what was the outcome of that case?
They essentially said Apple wouldn't give them access to it. And so it took them, I think, several million dollars, and the FBI hired an Israeli firm to basically break into the phone. But it was incredibly expensive, incredibly difficult to do because the phone was password protected and Apple wasn't willing to unlock the device for the FBI.
And there's other ways the FBI could have gotten that information, right?
Potentially. The most common way this is done is through through cellular information, right? The FBI would subpoena the cellular provider and say, hey, tell me where this device was at what time.
Oh, gotcha.
So that's the common way of doing this. We are, if you will, a much more difficult and cumbersome way of ever trying to get around access to this data. So privacy is really not a factor for us.
How many people in your organization, how long did it take to develop this system that we're using now?
So the Blinksy's been through, of course, several iterations like every startup has. We actually built the first sensor technology. My CTO basically built it on our conference room table from scratch in the matter of about 6 weeks. So it's not an incredibly complex technology that we've built, but the system, the actual implementation, is what was really daunting. So I climbed almost every pole here in Park City myself, pulled the ladder out of the back of my Subaru, strapped the sensors up to the pole, and then we had to build the entire architecture that makes sense of the data. So that's really what's valuable about what we build. We call it movement data intelligence on how people move. So rather than just building roads, for example, and telling people they should drive on them, we try to identify how people want to use the roads and try to make the infrastructure meet those needs. So a perfect example of this is what UDOT's using us for in Lehigh. So we have sensors deployed throughout the Lehigh Tech Corridor here and Salt Lake City area. And essentially what's happening is we're trying to understand how we can best make the infrastructure meet the needs of the community. So people are getting off the freeway and they're trying to head to these specific locations. Well, what routes are they taking? Why are they taking those routes? How often are they taking those routes? And how do we build the infrastructure, the on-ramps, the off-ramps, the number of lanes on the roadway, all that to actually meet the needs of the public rather than just putting roadways down and saying, we hope this meets your needs.
If we can go back to the data point though, Can anyone have access to this Wi-Fi information, this business card that my device is carrying? Is that open to the public, anyone to pick up?
Anyone can see it, essentially, if you have the technology or the ability to do it. So every router that you pass by, every Starbucks router, your device is likely trying to make a handshake with, is what it's called.
Because you've put together, to me, what sounds like a pretty obvious solution. No one had thought of it prior to 3 years ago?
So it's been implemented in a variety of pieces, but not quite in the way that we've done it. So as you can imagine, there are people who make sensors. There are people who make visualization technologies. And there are people who maybe aggregate data and statistics. We try to bring that all together. So think of us as the operating system for the smart city. So we actually compile existing data sets, everything from weather, events, roadway construction information, and compile it all into one place, basically to make it useful. We want to understand how weather and temperature and precipitation and volume information and the quality of the roadway all affect travel time at the same time, rather than thinking of them all piecemeal.
How's the weather, the precipitation, mm-hmm. How does it get into the system? It's not through these little gray boxes.
That's correct. Those are all different data feeds. So we actually pull data from the Weather Channel through a system called Weather Underground. So we actually are ingesting essentially live data feeds on what weather events are happening, right? You can imagine up here in Park City, snowfall, accumulation mm-hmm. of snow is one of the biggest factors that influences travel time. And we're trying to build systems that can essentially predict what's going to happen. So our sensor network has grown aggressively up here in the Park City area. Park City, Summit County, the Canyons have all deployed our sensors. We even have sensors permanently installed above TSA at the Salt Lake City Airport that helped Sundance quantify the economic impact of the film festival in the state of Utah last year.
Well, I had a really interesting conversation with Park City Manager Diane Foster this morning, anticipating this interview and asking her how the city has employed this technology. And she reminded me of Carmageddon, which all of us remember. That was December 2014. I think it was December 29th. So it was over the Christmas break. It was also a work day, busy snow day. There was a lot of snow that day. And we had gridlock. There were four key intersections down here that cars were not moving. And she said, essentially, you had that heavy traffic load. Then drivers were doing what they were supposed to do, which is, on a snowy day, leave a car length in front of you, between you and the other car, which essentially doubled or tripled the traffic that was probably already doubled or tripled. And people were pulling into intersections, ergo gridlock. They wanted to prevent that from happening again. Did they use you starting for 2015? Were you employed by then?
Our system went up for the very first time in 2015, June of 2015. It's been running for two solid years. So we were actually seeing that kind of, we saw that kind of that traffic at that time, but it was our first implementation. So we had only about 20 sensors, primarily focused around Main Street at the time. Then, of course, the following year, 2016, we grew the sensor network to about 60 sensors, and that's what's been running up here since then.
So that showed the real-time traffic. So the city could see a big load-in, is how Diane put it, going into the ski resort and know, okay, this is going to be a heavy traffic day. And they can do things like employ more buses or put the police cars at the intersections to keep people from pulling into intersections. And she said they even talked to the ski resorts about doing some food specials, you know, an appetizer special, après ski special, to keep people on the mountain a little longer to ease that big push of traffic as people are trying to get out of the resorts. And then she also mentioned that, you know, they'll call in here to KPCW when they see that real-time traffic. So then Randy Barton in the afternoon can tell everybody, hey, why don't you just stay on the mountain a little longer or grab some appetizers? And she does that thanks to your information that you provide. She said she was also watching Arts Festival this weekend, so she's at home and she can see the real-time traffic. Tell us what you saw with Arts Festival.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, similar to the rest of how the rest of our system works, we can understand everything from travel time and also the behavior of people, how much time they're spending in a given area. So we have a cluster of sensors on Park City Main Street, so we can actually understand the behavior of people on Main Street. Are they spending more or less time? Are there more or less people than average? Are they people who come here frequently or infrequently? Basically understanding the dynamic differences and what's happening in the city. And really the idea here is to affect behavior, to drive change. So you've probably seen on the side of the roadways here in Park City recently, big vehicle messaging signs, some that are permanent, some that can be moved. It's all part of an effort, a very innovative effort led by Diane and the very dedicated public servants at Park City that are trying to drive better efficiency in the transportation system. And our technology is a piece of that. And Arts Fest, of course, is one of the big contributing factors to traffic, but also economic development. So that's the interesting balance for us, as we focus both on the economic development analytics that help drive economic development decisions. For example, how much parking should be available or how long should the parking be available to help drive the kind of revenue that the businesses need to operate effectively. And so Sundance is an interesting hybrid of that, as is the Arts Festival, where you're trying to bring in a lot of people for a given amount of time that drives both economic development dollars, but at the same time creates a lot of traffic and congestion. So our system is used to identify basically all of those behaviors, where how people are getting to Main Street, where they're coming from, how much time it's taking them, and it's all anonymized.
Big Brother is watching you. Do you get a lot of people pushing back because of that?
We get initial questions on that for sure. I mean, Park City was very, very diligent. The city council was very interested and concerned about that initially as well. And once we, you know, made the case for why the data is protected, how we encrypt the transmission of the data, how the sensor itself is secure, and how really the data is data-based and how consumer privacy is protected, people felt a lot better about it. You know, these are difficult problems to solve. And you need to implement some innovative and more radical solutions to do that. And we think we've brought to the table a solution that balances really privacy interests, but also brings together that innovative type approach that can help drive solutions to these problems.
Can I step way back in this interview just for a moment? You look like you're about 16. So you go to the city of Salt Lake and say, I want to help you with this problem. What is their reaction?
Well, so I called the city traffic engineer and I asked why, and he was very, very kind and invited me in for a few hours to basically talk to him about the system works. Traffic engineers, we jokingly say there are three types of people who really make a huge difference in the world, doctors, teachers, and traffic engineers. And you know, teachers and doctors are pretty obvious, but what you have to think about traffic engineers is they're the only people who are incredibly underappreciated because when they're doing their job right, you don't notice. You don't think about them. When something goes wrong, that's when you blame them. And what they're tasked with doing, different than other engineers, is they don't get material sciences, right? They don't get to understand the amount of pounds of weight that concrete can support. These are not fixed variables. These are variables that humans cause. Humans that may or may not turn left or right at the intersection, that may or may not leave a car length of space in front of them. They can't predict how people are going to react, but it's their job to engineer and design roadways to accommodate their needs and try to predict human behavior, which is impossible to do. So you're talking to city engineers who are basically staring at fixed roadways every day, trying to eke out as much efficiency as possible. And what we literally came to say is, what can we do to help you be more efficient? And that's really how the technologies evolve. Our customer is the city engineer, the traffic engineer, the transportation consultant that the departments of transportation use. How do we help them make better decisions and make their job easier, which is also much better for taxpayers? We can reduce the burden on collecting this type of data, make it more cost effective and efficient to use it, and make data-driven decisions in real time.
So can you give us any specific information about this past weekend? Did you see anything about Arts Fest that you thought was interesting?
We haven't totaled the numbers quite yet, but it looks like Arts Festival this year seemed pretty consistent with what happened last year. We saw the amount of time people spent stay pretty consistent, right around 3 hours, just over 3 hours. That's pretty normal for us on a weekend here. It looks like Friday was actually the highest visitation day, which is also not super crazy. We've seen that a few times in the past. But we had some pretty consistent traffic through Saturday and Sunday as well.
So if you could say, I've studied the traffic patterns in Park City, and I think one thing that would really help is X.
Yes.
What would X be?
I wish I had the magic answer, as I'm sure Diane and others at the city wish I did for them as well. It's difficult, right? I mean, here's the biggest problem that we have. We've essentially built roads now at this point. There's not much more to go. There's not many other places you can add more lanes. And everyone's dealing with this problem. State of Utah in particular, we have, you know, the mountains on one side, the Salt Lake on the other side. You have a north and southbound freeway corridor, and you've got houses and buildings along the sides of them. Unless you're willing to essentially declare eminent domain and take those houses and rip them out, you have no space to put additional lanes down, mm-hmm. And that's a capacity issue.
Is there ever going to be perhaps an app where we also can look and see what some of the data is, what's going on presently?
Yeah, that's something we're actually working on right now. We've actually built a system like that for the Idaho Department of Transportation and have been working with Park City to understand specific applications and needs that could be built and how effective and efficient those would be here in Park City. What we really aim to do is affect behavior. So if you think about it, one of the biggest things we're working on is what's called bottleneck alleviation. So similar to how on-ramp and off-ramp metering works on the freeways, which you might be familiar with, right? The light turns red and green to help that. That's what we're trying to do with the traffic grid. If we can meter the number of people that are coming on, tell them how to affect their behavior just a little bit differently to make the experience better for everyone, we can basically create those gaps in the traffic grid that make it smoother and more efficient. That's what those vehicle messaging signs are designed to do as well. So that's the kind of system we're working towards building. Park City is a very, very innovative partner in this. Diane really leads an innovative organization up here. And that's what we're working with them to understand how we might be able to implement a system like that in the area.
Bottleneck alleviation. I love that phrase. And Diane told me that you're not just monitoring cars. It's who rides the bus, who's on a bike. You can see who's walking. If as long as that device is on them and it's on, you can see how they are moving in their community. So it's not just how do we build better roads. It can help them determine how do we best use mass transit. I guess you're seeing a lot with the e-bikes.
Absolutely, yeah. So hiking trails, dog parks, you name it. We can help you understand, right? Should we be putting money into a park? Is that park traffic locals? Is it non-locals? Where are they coming from? How much time do they spend there? Are we making the infrastructure meet the needs of the people, regardless of what it is? So the University of Utah is one of our largest customers. We have 100 sensors going in on campus this year, just alone to monitor how students use campus, how to make campus more efficient. So the Salt Palace has our sensors. The airport has our sensors. Even malls and shopping centers deploy our technology.
Well, it's interesting because you can see how people are currently using it, but it's going to be harder to determine how you alter how they use it,
we can
right?
see the before, during, and after trends, right? So it's a consistent, unique identifier that we collect. So we can actually see if that device's behavior changed.
Okay.
So detours are a good example of this. We help the departments of transportation understand how effective their detours are. When you're telling people they should turn and take this route instead of that route, and are you seeing that in the data a few days later?
You're talking about trails. So you're putting these little gray boxes at trailheads or... How are we counting
people? Yeah,
you'll see a few
of them here in Park City on the trails. They're all solar powered and they transmit on the cellular network. So you'll see these basically big posts. They'll probably have signs and maybe doggy bags and other things underneath them. But at the top is probably a solar panel with a little gray box and a Blinksy logo on it. And that's what it's helping you understand.
Seems like a pretty easy way to get some quantifiable data about who's coming in. And, you know, locals say, well, we don't go to Main Street anymore. Well, you can determine if a local person's going to Main Street.
We can. We do see that pretty consistently. We also see how often they come back. And that helps the city understand doing things like how to get what we call regulars to Main Street to take mass transit or to park in certain special parking designated areas to alleviate some of the traffic on Main Street. Those are exactly some of the challenges the city's grappling with today.
And what about Uber? Can you tell how Uber and Lyft has made a difference?
Yes and no. So we can see the differences in how traffic is coming to and from the city. We haven't quite gone to the level of being able to identify whether or not that is a rideshare or a non-rideshare. Just because if it's a car that's local and up here, it's hard to tell the difference in the data between the person when they're driving for Uber, when they're not, right? Their kids in the back seat or their riders in the back seat. So there's some differences like that make it a little more difficult.
Got it.
That's just amazing when you start thinking about all the data that you can collect in this system. What's next? Where do you want to take this?
Yeah, so for us, it's really accelerating this operating system mentality. So what we're working to do with some of the departments of transportation at the state level in particular is to aggregate all of their existing data sets. So think about it this way. Governments are flush with data, but they're not flush with data scientists. Why? Because it's very, very difficult to lure someone, one, on a government salary, and two, in a fairly oftentimes bureaucratic organization to go and work there, right? Data scientists are highly sought after. You know, we're talking high six-figure salaries here in the state of Utah, some of the big tech companies in Lehigh. And what we're trying to do is essentially be able to outsource that a little bit, so bring that service to government agencies. So that's really the focus for us, is taking all the existing data sets that taxpayers have already paid for, the systems that are already being collected, and make better sense of that, drive predictive insights, and help automate a lot of this process. Basically, infrastructure as a service is a component of our sensor technology, but data science as a service is a focus of ours for the future.
So I know there are probably a lot of parents out there listening right now who want to know what you studied in college.
Yeah, so I have a very, very diverse educational background. I spent 8 years at the University of Utah and have both 3 undergraduate and 3 graduate degrees.
What are they in?
So I have undergraduate degrees in political science, economics, and international studies, so very sort of liberal arts, social behavioral science focused. And then I have a JD, a law degree, an MBA, and a master's of international business.
Underachiever, apparently, Bob.
You need to slow down a little bit, Mark.
Yes. Well, thank you. Mark Pittman, CEO of Blinksy. Thank you for your time this morning. It's been really interesting. We could talk to you for another half hour, I'm sure. Have a great day.
We'll be right back.
Mountain Money on KPCW is sponsored in part by Columbus Pacific Properties, presenting Viridian, 21 new residences along the 11th fairway of the Canyons Golf Course with year-round amenities and gondola access. Summers on the fairway, winters on the slopes. More information at ViridianParkCity.com.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City, a Park City law office. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo has been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at JonesWaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. It is about 9:32. This is Renee Bodley here with my co-host Bob Hendricks, who's also our esteemed producer, filling in for Doug Wells, who's on vacation today. Hi, Bob.
And he'll be back next week, and you won't. So we're just kind of trading people every other week. So.
It's summertime, right?
Yes,
that's what happens
that's
around
right.
here. I'm really excited about this next guest.
I have been trying to get a hold of Lauren for about 3 weeks now, and she always has an excuse. So I'm glad to see her today.
Hey, nice. Thanks for having me on here today.
Lauren Smaha is one of the owners of Freshy's Lobster right here in Park City. And in case anyone has missed any news in the past 3 weeks, you just won Best Lobster Roll in America.
Yeah, actually, the world. It's the,
world.
The world's best. So, yeah, so my husband and I went back. He's the other owner, Ben. We went back to Portland, Maine, I guess 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. I cannot even keep track. But we went back there for a competition, lobster roll competition, where there were 250 VIP guests who would, they had three tokens, and they could take their tokens and put all three of their tokens in their most favorite lobster roll, or they could spread them out to their top three. So the top three, which we obviously got selected, went on to a panel of 6 judges. And then out of those 6 judges tasted all 3 lobster rolls, kind of gave their analysis of it, went behind the curtain, came back, and they said we were the winner.
And this was a contest sponsored by Down East Magazine, and it was in Portland, Maine.
Yes, exactly. So Down East Magazine, they're actually a big publication out of Maine, and it was the first inaugural competition that they held, and they were it was a little unorganized event, but ultimately it was a really fun event for everybody, and went really well.
Can we step back just a little? Mm-hmm. You got your start at Silly Market, Park Silly Market.
Yes, the Park Silly Market. This is our 10th year in Park City actually doing this. A lot of people, just because we've never marketed it, it's just kind of word of mouth has been our strategy all along, just a side job for my husband and I. 9 years ago at the Park Silly Market, my husband and his other friend actually were doing lobster rolls. And then as the other friend stepped away, I kind of came in as a more serious role. And we got the food truck in 2013. So I think that really jump-started things as well.
So how did it begin? You're all sitting around one day and you like to cook lobster? Or what?
So
how did this happen?
It actually all started out in 2008. So my husband had 2 other roommates, both Mainers. And one of them was, he just started shipping lobsters in and selling lobsters out of his truck. He went back to Maine to be with a girl that he had met. So he moved back east. And so then this is right when my husband and I started dating. And we were kind of all sitting around like lobster, we do lobster. And it came up to do lobster rolls. We actually did it at the farmer's market as well on Wednesdays. And then the Park Silly. And we also did live lobsters back then too. So that's kind of where it was born and how it started.
Can you explain to our listeners, what is a lobster roll?
Right, yeah, very, very confusing question, especially to Californians. It's not talking sushi here.
Right?
Yeah, which a lot of people think it is. A lobster roll is traditionally served on a New England-style hot dog bun, which is something we ship out because I have tried and tried and tried, and you cannot, no bread distributor, you can't get them out here. So we ship these buns in. It's a split-top hot dog bun, which absolutely are part of making this a fabulous sandwich. And we put fresh picked lobster meat in, hot butter on the top. That's a lobster roll. You'll get so many different varieties in Maine and up the coast of New England, whether they're mixing it with mayo and celery, or you know every region kind of has its own little thing. But we found my favorite part of it is just keeping the lobster the main ingredient, make that the standout ingredient. No need to mask it in mayonnaise and add celery and all that stuff. So.
Well, they talked about the seasonings you use. Apparently, the people who were voting really liked how you season it. So without giving away a trade secret, what's the seasoning
yeah,
like?
Yeah, it's just a mixture of some dried herbs and some peppers and salts that have some other ingredients in it. Yeah.
You developed that? That's
yes,
your
I did.
Recipe?
Yep. It was, accumulation of a few other seafood dishes that I really liked that had used that as an ingredient. And I kind of just mixed it up and
do you have a background in cooking?
I don't have a background in cooking. I did, for a while, during the startup of this, I was a private chef for a family and did work. I just love food. And I think if you have a love for food, if you like eating food and have a good palate, you can cook well. It's just all about flavors. And I think because I like food so much, it helps me develop good recipes and good menu items.
I'm envisioning a big load of lobsters coming into wherever they come in by air or by truck.
Yep,
or?
It comes in. We could UPS it. It's a lot more cost effective for us to use Southwest Cargo.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to go down to the airport and pick up the shipment. They drive it to Boston, gets on a flight, usually is here within 8 hours. But now I actually use a transportation company, Four Seasons, and they're Sam Rubin. He's awesome. He actually does all my deliveries. He'll text me. He's like, "What's coming in? What time?" He's always getting it there on to me as quick as possible. He'll even like send me his routing because there's times where we're literally like about to run out of meat. So I'm sitting there on my phone tracking where he is, texting them. I'm like, "He'll be there in 5 minutes. He'll be there in 5 minutes." So it's really, really awesome. He's actually been doing some Costco runs for me as well, getting our potato chips up here because we're going through so many potato chips and we don't have enough storage for it.
It's labor intensive. I mean, already processed
yes,
and
they
ready
do.
For you.
Yep, they do.
Oh, they do.
Yep.
Okay.
So big, there's a facility. So they get them off the boats, cook it right there in seawater. And then they seal it up. They have like a, it's a nitrogen sealing process. So it's all airtight. And then so we get the meat shipped in. I one time back in 2010 did look into, actually shucking lobsters. And it was like going to be more money. Each sandwich actually is an entire lobster. So our $20 sandwich is about equivalent to a 1 pound to 1.25 pound lobster. A lot of people don't. They're like, "No way." And I'm like, "Absolutely. A 1 pound lobster yields about 3.5 ounces to 3.75 ounces of lobster meat."
And that explains why it's a $20 sandwich. I'm sure some people go to your restaurant and think, "Whoa, wait a minute. I didn't expect to see that." But they
absolutely
clearly don't understand the cost of lobster.
The cost of lobster. I mean, there's a few surprises, especially for people who haven't been on the East Coast. There's a lot of East Coasters who are like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're doing it this cheap with the shipping." They get it. They know. My husband and I sat on a dock in Maine the night before this competition, ate a $24 lobster roll. And we're sitting under lobsters. So it's people who aren't accustomed to that and don't know the cost of lobster do get a little bit, we get a lot of reviews, awesome food, but a little expensive. We're actually right on par with what you'd get in a tourist town in Maine. And if you go to the grocery store, $23.99 for per pound. So a pound and a quarter lobster ends up costing you about $28. Plus you have to cook and shuck it. So
what else do you have on your menu? Because what do you do when lobster's not available?
Right. Well, when lobster's not available, we actually can get lobster year-round. That was one of the reasons that really held us back from opening a restaurant for so long. But we can get lobster year-round. So, there's what we have done this since we've literally grown 6 times overnight. Like, everything has been 6 times. we have run into some issues where the lobster meat, we've run out of lobster meat, and we will just close our doors. So it's a bummer. I posted on Facebook. I posted on our website. But also, I think it's kind of fun. I mean, it's just the nature of the business. You know, it's here. It's shipped in overnight. And if it's not, then, you know, it's...
It makes it exciting. And then there's an exclusivity factor that's appealing to your customers.
Totally.
So when they do get that $20 roll, I mean, you have lines out the door at your restaurant.
Yeah. I honestly didn't think we would win this competition. I thought it would be just no Maynard was going to vote for us. In that first initial round, I really thought, you know, people would be like, oh, Utah, we're not voting for a Utah company. But they all stood there and said, oh my gosh, I don't want to do this, but you guys really, this was the best one. But yeah, it's been the lines out the door. I had no idea that was, you know, I never thought we were going to win. And if we won, I would have never had guessed that this happened. But the day after we came back, that Monday, I was getting calls from KSL, I had every news station up there doing interviews. And after every time one of those interviews news played on the TV station, the next day it was like, line out the door, line out the door.
Because it's a great story. Who would ever expect a restaurant in Utah to have the best lobster roll? And I'm going to read a lead sentence from the Boston Globe. This was July 11th. So I guess you won the weekend after 4th of July?
Yeah, we won, I think, July 8th. So it was July 11th of Tuesday.
Yeah, so this was a July 11th article in the Boston Globe. New England claimed Utah's most notable athlete when the Boston Celtics lured free agent Gordon Hayward from the Jazz this month. But the Beehive State struck back in a big way last weekend, claiming top prize in the world's best lobster roll competition. You threw it down.
Yeah, I mean, I loved reading that. I was
Our Gordon Hayward, we'll take your best lobster roll title.
And I was a basketball player, too. So it was super fun to read that. And, you know... I still call New England my home, but, you know, Utah obviously is our home. We're never, you know, I don't see us leaving here. And it was really, I can't believe we're in the Boston Globe. It was really exciting.
So this hits a month ago, and then you come home, and next day you open for business, and what did you see?
just people lining out the door, and it was like, oh my gosh, here we go. You know, we still had the same amount of staff, yet we're doing, you know, five times the numbers right away.
Have you hired more people?
Yes. So in the middle of the chaos, and the reason I haven't been able to get in here, I have been making lobster rolls while training, and there's no training. It's just, okay, do this, and it's get your hands in here and let's go. And, you know, our staff has been so great dealing with, you know, just literally not having lunch breaks. They're just, you get into a position in there for their shift, and they are there the entire shift. I mean, we're lucky if we can get water breaks.
Where is the store located, and what are your hours?
So we are on, we're 1897 Prospector Ave. Mm-hmm. We're open Monday through Saturday from 11 till 8. Sundays we shut down the restaurant just because we are at the Park City Market. Once if we can get some more staff, we probably will open again on Sundays because we were all winter. So just to...
And can you explain to our listeners, what's the ambiance like? What's the experience when they walk into Freshies?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of went for the New England, you know, clam shack, you know, lobster hut type place. It's very casual. You come up to the counter, you order your food, and hopefully you can find a seat. A lot of people are taking it to go, but usually by the time they get their food, there's a seat that's cleared up. And just casual, fun, you know, kind of beachy themed. I have a bunch of, you know, beach prints up on the wall, and just nice and airy.
Anything else you want to tell our listeners about this wild roller coaster ride you've been on?
You know, we just want to thank the community, really, for supporting us for 10 years and pushing us to get the restaurant.
That's absolutely amazing. Lauren, we appreciate you being here. Lauren is from the Freshies Lobster Company, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
Where I'm going to be there about 2 o'clock this afternoon.
Perfect. I will see
shot.
You there.
Yeah. I've never had a lobster roll, so this will be
gosh.
A first for me. So.
All right.
Lauren Smaha, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and KPCW sponsor. Epic Promise grants focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our community. Grants fund programs that help kids achieve great things in the classroom and develop a passion for the outdoors by engaging guests, our local community, and employees to create a more promising future. More information at epicpromise.com.
We're back on Mountain Money. I'm Bob Hendricks along with Renee Bodley. Doug Wells is on vacation today, and we're happy to talk with Dr. Michael Kagan, who it's called concierge medicine. Is that correct?
Sure. That's one way to say it.
Okay. Let's talk first about you, Dr. Kagan, your background, how long you've been in Park City, and what gave you this idea to do this type of medicine here?
Okay. So my family and I moved to Park City in March. I have a wife. She's a pediatrician down in Heber. Her name is Zainab Kagan. I have a three-year-old son. He's tearing up the trails here in Park City on a Strider bike. And what gave us the idea to move out to Park City is I have a speed skating background, and I have friends that moved out here back just before the 2002 Winter Olympic Games, and they're raising families here now. They said it's a wonderful place. You have to check it out. When my family and I came out here, we just really enjoyed it, and we wanted to make this our home.
And so what made you decide to go into concierge medicine? Tell us what your medical training is and then what concierge medicine is and why you got there.
Absolutely. So I am an internal medicine physician, so I specialize in taking care of adult patients. And I was practicing in a large hospital association for several years, and I felt like I just didn't have the time I needed with my patients. So I wanted to make things much more convenient for them. I wanted to really give my patients the time that they need. And my direct primary care practice, which is also a concierge practice, allows me to do that.
And what is a concierge practice?
So there's several different ways of having a concierge practice, but I think that a concierge practice just offers concierge services. So I offer same-day appointments, I offer video and phone conferences, I do home visits when medically appropriate. My patients have a direct phone line to me, and so they have access to me all the time.
So I was going to say pager. I was about to date myself. So your cell phone could ring at any time of day, night, any day of the week. You're essentially on call 24/7?
Yes, that's correct.
And how many patients do you have?
So I'm limiting my practice size to 200 members in the first year, and so it keeps it very manageable. I can really afford to give people the time that they need with that patient size. And so I have a different practice model. It's called direct primary care, where I don't bill insurance. I have one yearly membership fee. And for that one yearly membership fee, I take care of all of my patients' primary care needs. So anything outside of the hospital, they call me.
What is that fee?
It varies. If you go to KaganMD.com and go to membership, it varies based on age, but if you go to the website, you can see that everything is transparent there.
Can you give our listeners just a range?
Sure. So it starts out at $100 a month, so it varies from $1,200 a year up to $3,000 a year. And by not billing insurance, I'm really able to keep my overhead costs low and pass those savings on to my patients.
And explain what a primary care is, what you would be doing versus what you would need to be affiliated with a larger medical group.
Got it. Yeah. So primary care is either pediatrics, family medicine, or internal medicine. I specialize in internal medicine, so I'm taking care of adult patients. And primary care is really care that's taking place outside of the hospital. I do visit my patients in the hospital and participate in medical decisions that are happening in the hospital. But anything that is outside of the hospital, you know, preventative visits, acute visits, just any question that you would have for your physician, my patients call me directly and I answer their call and get them taken care of.
So I have a primary care physician. I go in every 3 months to get prescriptions and get a checkup. And that's basically what you're doing then. I would call you and say, my meds are up, and can we come in and talk about that? And
absolutely. And with my model of direct primary care, I don't need to actually bring you into the office. A lot of times we can take care of things over the phone or by a video visit, but I don't have to create a billable encounter for the insurance companies. My practice is very simple. For that membership fee, I'm just taking care of you, and I'm your personal physician.
So as my personal physician, would you say, Renee, in the next year, I want to see you X number of times and we're going to do X number of tests? I mean, are you sort of prescriptive as well as what a patient needs?
Everything is individualized. So I absolutely like to see my members at least once a year. But they're welcome to see me as much as they like. So for that membership fee, I offer unlimited office visits, phone calls, and video visits. So if you need to follow up weekly for something, we can do that as well.
If I had an elderly parent and I say, Dr. Kagan, can you please make sure that you see my parent X number of times a year? Do you do that kind of service as well?
I do that as well. I have a different level of service too that is exclusively if someone needs to be seen in an assisted living facility or exclusively at home, I do that as well, where more than half of the visit encounters take place in the person's home. I do that as well.
So how do you avoid the high maintenance patient, the one who calls you every day with every ache and pain?
So far, it hasn't come up, but I mean, I'm happy to address any problem with my patients and, really get down to the root cause of what's ailing them and help them, turn things around.
Are you seeing other patients besides the concierge patients, or is this just something that you do only?
Yeah, no, I only take care of members in my practice. Okay. And so by limiting the membership size, it really allows my patients to have access to me all the time. So I guarantee that they'll be either seen the day that they want to be seen, at the latest the next day.
So if there are tests needed, then it comes outside of your reach. Then you would recommend a test? Can you arrange that test for them, or do you point them in the direction to have the test done? How does that work?
So anything that I can do in the office, I don't charge patients for. I do draw labs as a courtesy to them. I definitely recommend having an insurance plan as well, to cover medications, costs of labs or imaging, specialist visits, especially hospitalizations. So I recommend having an insurance plan. But anything I do in the office is covered in the membership fee.
When you say draw labs, so then you can draw blood and then you send it out to someone else?
Correct. Okay. Yes, that's right. And it can be charged directly to someone's insurance. I also have cash prices worked out. If you wanted to pay a cash price, which is generally a lot less than what you would pay using your insurance. So if you're using a health savings account and you wanted a cash price on an imaging procedure or a laboratory exam, or even a specialist visit, I have cash prices worked out for all of those.
I had a primary care physician where we lived before that used to grumble about how much pressure was put on him by the organization that he worked for and the insurance company to get people in and get people out. This is something you don't worry about then. This is your time.
That's something I did worry about in my former practice, and that's why I changed. I really like spending time with my patients and giving them the time that they need. And when you're in the fee-for-service world, which is billing the insurance companies, you have to see a very high number of patients to make a living. And it's very difficult because there's other tasks that are thrown your way by administrators, throughout the day that are not related to patient care. And my practice now is focused totally on just taking care of my patients and giving them the care that they need.
This was quite a step to take for you. A lot of thought, a lot of research?
A lot of research, a lot of planning. In medicine, physicians are extremely helpful. So I have a lot of physician friends that help me out with starting my practice. I've had family members help me starting my practice as well, because I have several family members that are in private practice as well. But the direct primary care community across the country is growing, and it's very collaborative. There's other physicians that help me out tremendously in getting my practice started. And I help out other physicians as well. I have people calling me up and say, hey, how did you do this? How can I get started? And I'm happy to help other physicians.
It would probably require a pretty large initial financial investment, I would guess.
Yeah.
To establish the office and...
It does. So I try to keep my overhead costs as low as possible. I just started my practice 3 months ago. It's going very well. I have people coming in every week, and it's great. I think I have very happy patients, and I'm very happy practicing in the style of practice that I am.
It sounds like you're the good old-fashioned country doctor.
That's right. I do house calls just like my grandfather used to, and it brings a lot of pleasure into practicing medicine. It's actually a lot of fun to do that.
Do you take a little black bag with you when you go?
I have the briefcase that's sitting in the other room, and it has everything I need in it.
All right.
So can you essentially be a patient's healthcare advocate? If something develops with one of your patients that turns into a more complicated medical matter where they need ongoing care, hospitalization, recovery, can you be the one where I can say, Dr. Kagan, they're talking Greek. I don't get what they're saying with these medical terms. Can you please interpret for me and be my advocate?
Absolutely. That's a large part of what I do. And if one of my patients needs to see a specialist, oftentimes I can take care of things because I have an extensive training in internal medicine. I also have an extensive network of friends in every medical specialty, and I have the time to call them up and discuss the care of my patients. But when they do need to see a specialist, every consultation is done physician to physician. I talk directly with the physician that they're going to be seeing, and I am their advocate in the hospital and out of the hospital. And it's a very complicated healthcare system to navigate, and that's what I'm here to do, is help navigate that system with my patients.
Just doing some research on concierge medicine, it showed that the demographic that most goes for concierge medicine is an older demographic. Are you finding that with your patients here?
I find so far, yeah, I think retirees enjoy extended office visits, you know, unhurried office visits. That's been the case quite a bit. Also, the membership really works well for anyone that has a busy lifestyle. You know, they don't have half a day to take off from work to go see the doctor. They like having their doctor in their phone where they can just call me directly, do a quick video visit or a phone call, and get their issue addressed. And also, anyone that has a high deductible healthcare plan, it really makes sense financially and just convenience-wise to have me as their physician.
How do you work with Medicare?
So I don't work with Medicare. I don't work with any third-party payer.
Okay.
So my patients, many of my patients do have Medicare, which will cover the cost of their labs, imaging, specialists, and hospitalizations. But my membership fee is something that they pay out of pocket.
So they're on their own dealing with Medicare then? Anything that is Medicare-related, you're not getting involved in that?
No, I mean, I submit everything. So everything is billed directly to them for labs or imaging or their specialist visits. But anything I do in the office is just covered with a membership fee, which is something totally separate from Medicare.
And when you say billed to them, you mean billed to the patient or billed to Medicare?
Everything would be billed directly to Medicare.
To Medicare.
As far as labs, imaging, their consultations or hospitalizations, they're in Medicare. I'm opted out of Medicare, and I just have a very simple practice where, you know, this is the amount of money, and I'm just going to take care of you for that amount of money.
Can you give us an idea of who the patient is who pays $100 a month versus who the patient is who pays $3,000 a month?
Yeah, so it's age tiered. So looking around, doing a lot of research into this before I got started, it seemed like that pricing structure was the best pricing structure that worked out. I looked at successful practices and unsuccessful practices, and it turns out the insurance companies do sort of a similar pricing structure, where it just gets a little bit more expensive as you age.
And do I have to sign a contract with you? Is it a yearly contract? Is it a monthly? How does it work?
So the only paperwork my patients do is the first time they see me. We have a membership agreement. There's also some HIPAA documents that they sign. And after that, the contracts are self-renewing, and you don't have to do any more paperwork. It's just very simple.
And can drop out at any time?
Yes. With 30 days notice, you can drop out any time.
And can you drop out at any time?
No, not ethically. I can't.
Yeah.
And so, no, I don't.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We appreciated Dr. Michael Kagan coming in. Concierge Medicine in Park City. How do they get a hold of you?
KaganMD.com, KaganMD.com. You can also call me and I'll answer your call, 435-MD-DOC-MD.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kagan. Very interesting. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Our thanks to Mark Pittman, founder and CEO of Blinksky, Lauren Smaha of Freshy's Lobster, and Dr. Michael Kagan, who's in studio. Thanks to our great sponsors for Mountain Money, Mountain West Bank, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Jones Waldo Holbrook and McDonough, All Resort Express, Park City Mountain and Apex Residences, and Viridian Park City, Columbus Pacific Properties. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here, Bob. And Doug Wells will be back from vacation next week. I won't be. See you in a couple weeks.
All right. Thank you. You're listening to KPCW Park City. We're at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. It's time now to go to NPR.